everybody. Welcome to Blind Like Me, another edition. It's Phil Parr here, along with George. Is it Wurzville? Is that
Wurzville.
The word? Wurzville. That's the way you pronounce it. He and I have been, you and I have been playing phone tag for a month now. I think the first time you called, I had some, I don't know, some the whimsy or something disease, and I set up a couple appointments and wasn't able to keep them, and I'm sure you thought, geez, this guy's a flake. I wouldn't have blamed you if you had. Anyway, where do you live, sir? Where are you from?
Oh, I presently live in Lansing, Michigan. I was born in Saginaw, Michigan. Have retinitis pigmentosis and started off with really bad eyes to start with. Never saw well enough to read any kind of, you know, normal print of any sort.
Uh-huh.
And then by the time I was 18 years old, probably had no usable vision to speak of whatsoever.
But you had a little vision as a youngster.
Very, very little, yep.
Not enough to, but enough to, I always ask this, enough to identify colors?
Colors a little bit, and I used to, we were talking about this yesterday, about people riding bicycles and different things, and I used to ride a bicycle around in my neighborhood when I was a kid, and of course, if you have retinitis pigmentosis, you see relatively well when there's good light, but we had some huge shade trees along our street that when I rode in underneath those, I just kind of, you know, took a chance and knew I was going to come out on the other end at some point in time.
And hope that you...
But I terrorized our poor mailman. I hit him twice as a youngster. And
really?
Yes, he thought I was Dennis the Menace.
You ran into the mailman twice?
Twice. Both times from the backside. He didn't hear me.
He didn't hear you, and of course you didn't see him and didn't hear him.
Yeah. Yep.
And you were balancing a two-wheel bicycle all this time.
Yep.
And what age? You say you were raised, born and raised where?
Started off in Saginaw, Michigan. Then when
Saginaw.
I was a little kid, we moved to Traverse City, Michigan, which
so you,
is where I spent most of my youth.
You've been a Michigan boy all your life.
Yep.
As a youngster, I guess if you rode a bicycle, then your parents were pretty permissive with the little blind George riding around with on his bike. I love it.
Yeah. I had for that point in time, you know, I had a dad who thought that even though we didn't see well, we should still do everything, and had came out of a huge family. As far as immediate family, we were only two kids, but I had my nine uncles on my dad's side and
yeah.
Eight on my mother's side, and all of my dad's uncles, aunts and uncles and everything were all farmers. So I actually spent quite a bit of time working on a farm when I was a kid, baling hay and cleaning stalls and milking cows and those types of things.
Well, to me, that sounds like an ideal childhood. I'm sure it wasn't, but you did have good family support, lots of aunts and uncles. And
I look back on other kids, and I think I had a spectacular childhood. I mean, I rode horses, I rode cows, played rodeo, baled hay. You know you are well accepted by your aunts and uncles when you're staying at their house and you get a licking right along with the rest of the kids for something you shouldn't have been doing.
Then they're not protecting you or trying to coddle you because you're blind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it ought to be. That's because life certainly isn't going to cut you any slack, as you found out.
Yeah. I attended Michigan School for the Blind, which is a residential school for the blind, starting in second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And attended through 11th grade. I left there and went back to Traverse City, Michigan, went to Traverse City Public School. And
well, let's talk a little bit, before you leave there, let's talk a little bit to Michigan School. I think we may have had one other person that went there, and I think he said that it was a pretty good school.
It was an incredibly progressive school. It is now diminished to absolutely nothing, but when I was there back in the 60s and very early 70s, we had a marching band that, you know, participated in parades and everything.
Mm-hmm.
We had a full auto shop where kids learned auto shop. We had a full woodworking shop, full metalworking shop, taught all kinds of industrial arts, taught chair caning, piano tuning, and those kinds of normal things. But we also had a vocational program to learn to be a Volkswagen mechanic, which I went through totally. And I worked at a Volkswagen dealership for a little while, and figured out I didn't like getting greasy and dirty.
But they actually let you use the power tools and things in the wood shop and in the mechanic shop.
Absolutely.
See, that's the deal with the Texas school. They had lots of power tools. They just wouldn't let us blind folks use them. Mm-hmm. And so they taught you Braille at an early age.
Learned Braille.
You do that well? Still use it or not?
I still use Braille every day. I'm a huge advocate of Braille, even though we have technology in this world.
Yeah.
There is absolutely nothing better than having note cards in your pocket to walk up to a podium and give a speech with. It's impossible to do it well any other way.
I wouldn't say impossible, but it is difficult.
It makes you, to the general public, appear as though you're presenting a speech in a similar manner to what they're accustomed to.
Well,
even I know people that do a really good job memorizing their speech and everything, and you can do a little bit with electronics, with note takers and that, and an earpiece in your ear. But I think if you're, for me anyways, the Braille card thing is the key to making me look similar to my colleagues mm-hmm. and present in a similar manner.
Well, even I, the worst Braille reader in the world, if I'm going to give a speech that's about the material that I'm not real familiar with, I take a card and I have a label maker, so I'll put six or eight little labels on there just to remind me of what I wanted to talk about my next little notes, and lay it up there and just move my hand along it. So, yeah, it's a good idea. I've tried it the other way with an earpiece, and that's distracting because you're trying to talk and listen at the same time. And it's really hard to do. You're right. Obviously, you have some experience making speeches.
Very much. Recently, especially.
All right, but don't get away from this school for the blind. So you considered it, you had a good situation there at the Michigan School for the Blind.
What really taught me what a good experience it was and what kind of good training that I got there as far as skills of blindness went. When I was a senior in high school, I went to the local high school in Traverse City. And I walked in there on the starting day and went to my classes and was able to walk into my classroom and talk to the teacher and tell them exactly what I needed to survive in their classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Which tells me that now, in hindsight, looking back, I look at kids today and how much time they spend in aids. They get a parapro assigned to them to help them with, all their needs through the course of the day. And I walked in as an individual and walked up and said to the teacher, I says, I'm blind. I cannot see what's on your chalkboard. If you could just kindly, when you're writing on the chalkboard, verbally tell me what's up there. I take tests three different ways. I says you can provide them in Braille and I will do them. You can provide them on a tape and I'll do them. Or you can, find someone to read them to me. Or you can read them to me yourself. Or I'll find someone to read them to me.
So when she was putting something on the blackboard, she would tell you what she was putting, or she or he would tell you what they're putting on the blackboard, and you would take Braille notes Braille notes at your seat with a plain old fashioned tablet and stylus.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. Susie Barnes carries one in her purse all the time. She wouldn't be without one. Now, what year was this? We didn't have
computers. 1973 is when I went to Traverse City High School.
So we didn't have computers or any of that sort of technology. None of that kind of thing. So you were strictly Braille. And why did they make the decision to take you from the Michigan school and move you and come back to Traverse City?
It's kind of a convoluted story, but...
We got time for convoluted stories, sir.
My father and I had a discussion when I was 13 years old that if I got straight A's in school at the School for the Blind during that school year, that I could go to Traverse City Public School the next year because I wanted to go there. I wanted to go to a public school. And with the exception of the marking period in which my father passed away... that year, I got straight A's that year, and then it came, the next year to go back to school, and I told my mother I wanted to go to Traverse City Public Schools, and she wouldn't let me. She told me I was going back to the School for the Blind. So I went back as a rather disgruntled student, and my grades were poor for the next couple years. And then my senior year in high school, I was 18 years old, so I stayed the summer between my junior and senior year in Lansing and worked at the Volkswagen dealership, and then when it was time to go to the first day of school, I went to the first day of school in Traverse City, Michigan, because I was a senior. I was 18 years old. I could go where I wanted, so I just went there and said, I want to go to your school.
You were 18 years old, so you just disobeyed Mama.
Yep.
I'm sure she got past that.
It took her a while, but she did.
Did you, you felt like you wanted to go to Traverse City High School because you, for social reasons, or why did you, what made you want to do that?
A little bit of a rebellious kid, and I thought that the School for the Blind was stifling my interests in the world. And we all think that when we're kids.
Well, yeah, everybody's stifling your interest in the world.
And my graduating class at the School for the Blind would have been 32 kids. When I went to Traverse City High School, there was 1,100 kids in my graduating class.
Wow.
So it was a nice dose of reality as how the world really worked.
It was a great thing to do, but you couldn't know that then. We would have no way of knowing as 18-year-old. Sure, looking back on it, it was the thing to do. Probably should have done it in the 10th grade.
Yeah, and I got good grades. And there was a couple things, I think, that made me incredibly successful at the school, and the fact that I had really good, you know, blindness skills. I mean, I had good mobility skills, which I'd learned at the School for Blind. I had good Braille skills, which I'd learned at the School for the Blind. And I'd learned, they were really good at the School for the Blind at teaching you how to learn. I mean, because all the things that you needed there, there was no adapting anything to anybody because it was already adapted. They were already used to teaching blind people. And the one thing that made me instantly accepted at Traverse City High School was the fact that I was an incredibly good Volkswagen mechanic, and this was in 1973, so there was a huge amount of Volkswagens around, and kids, that was cheap transportation, and
dangerous but cheap.
So I was instantly accepted. I took an auto shop class when I was there, and I was instantly the hero because I knew absolutely everything about Volkswagen. So. And the other thing that I tell kids, young kids today, is the fact that when you're in a school situation and you're a junior or senior or whatever and you don't drive, you have to find a way to trade people, you know, things to do for you begging for rides. And one of the things that I know that I was incredibly fortunate about, I had this extremely cool, neat, souped-up Volkswagen. It just went like a bat out of hell.
That belonged to you.
Yeah, and it was mine. And everybody wanted to drive it. I mean, it had a really cool paint job on it. It had a souped-up VW engine in it with fancy exhaust, and it was incredibly fun for people to drive. So I had a list of people who always wanted to drive my car.
And when they drove, then you got to ride. You got to go where you wanted to do, to the ice cream store, to the grocery, or to the skating rink, or wherever.
Yep.
Wherever you wanted to go. It's very bright. Now I see your logic and your reasoning for wanting to go to high school. But, you know, you're talking about your mobility skills are good. Good. Did they teach you mobility at the blind school?
Relatively well. It was, you know, it's one of those kind of things that you learned through osmosis almost at the School for the Blind because it was a very large campus. It's 35 acres. You know, you had to walk from building to building continually. You know, all the buildings were separate. The high school building was separate from the gymnasium. The gymnasium was separate from the industrial arts building. They were all separate from the dining facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you had to walk for every meal. You had to go somewhere. For the change of every class that wasn't academic, you had to go somewhere. Anytime you wanted to go to the library, you had to walk. So you just, through the process of having to do that every day, you became a good traveler.
Yeah, but I think the more I'm around blind people, and I'm sure that my opinions change every day about things, and maybe this will change, I believe mobility skills, you either got them or you don't.
I think that's very true with people who see.
Yeah, I guess you either understand directions and how to get places or you don't.
Yep.
But especially when you're blind, I used to think, well, why didn't that blind person that can't get around, why don't they learn to get around? I think there are blind people who don't have that ability, who just can't do that.
I can, if I'm in a house or a building or whatever, when I walk in the front door, you know, I don't care where I go in that building, how big it is, mall or whatever, I always have a reference point in my head as to how to get back. I'm a really good rat. I can get back and get my piece of cheese, you know. I seem to have an innate sense of north, south, east, west, up, down. I always know in a house, especially if I walk in the door and have been upstairs and downstairs, I know exactly where I'm in relationship to the other two floors.
I do in a house. Now, if I go to the mall with my wife, sighted wife, I don't pay any attention because I don't have to.
Yeah.
But if I go in a house, the first thing I do is, well, first thing I want to know is where's the bathroom? Because
yep.
I don't want to have to ask somebody to take me to the bathroom and lead me through, you know, through 50 other people that are having drinks. Look at that. Isn't that wonderful? She's taking the poor blind fool to the bathroom. I want to be able to do that myself.
Yep.
So that is point one. But there are people who don't have the ability you have, and I have.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen people with more of it than I've seen blind people who make me look like a pauper. But I'm pretty good. I've learned. My sister and brother-in-law built a house that has, when you come in from the garage, you go through a little mud room, and then you're in the kitchen, and the kitchen is funny shaped. I still have not learned. I know all their house but the kitchen, and I need to go over there when there's nobody there and learn that. So, blind school, good. Graduated high school, graduated from public high school.
Yep.
I tell you what, let's do. Let's take a break, then we'll get you into college or whatever you did when you finished high school. George Wurzbach is our guest, and we'll be back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me. Hang on. Serve.
The thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List, and it worked.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my cane caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at blindmysmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is blindmysmart.com. Again, that's www.blindmysmart.com.
George Wurzbach is our guest, and we're back with the more Blind Like Me. We have you in the high school, graduating. You think you said
Traverse City
High School. You graduated high school. What did you think you wanted to do with your life?
I started taking, this was on the very cutting edge. Traverse City is a pretty progressive town. You could, when you were a senior in high school, you could take college classes and get what they call dual enrollment nowadays. You could take college classes at the same time you were enrolled in high school, and you could get some of those classes to at double dip, more or less. They would apply for your college degree as well as act for credits to graduate from high school. So I started doing that my senior year when I was at Traverse City High School and was going to get a degree in business. And went for what would have been the second half of my senior year to college, and then during the course of the summer, started working in Traverse City. I worked at a part-time at a bicycle shop, and then I started working part-time for a friend of mine who was a boat builder, and fussing around at his shop and working in woodworking and stuff, and started building a little bit of lawn furniture. Thought I'd build some lawn furniture and put it out on the front yard.
And make a buck or two, yeah.
And I built a little bit of lawn furniture and put it out on the front yard and built ten of the chairs and put them out there. And at the end of 2 weeks, I had sold two, and those were both to the same guy. And that was at the end of the second week. But he came back, and he says, I want to buy 100 of those. And I was in the woodworking business.
This was some guy that had a way to sell. I mean, he wanted to sell them to other people.
No, he wanted them for, they went to Detroit Yacht Club. I lived in Traverse City. Detroit's 300 miles away, but he vacationed in Traverse City.
And he saw your chairs, and he bought a couple, liked them, and decided, I want to buy two more.
And bought 100 of them for the yacht club.
Okay, now how'd you get a design for that chair? Did you just come up with it out of your head, or what?
No, it was purely stolen. Saw one that I liked what it was like. Knew a guy that was building them, went over to his shop. He gave me a pile of parts. Here's what they are. Go build them to your heart's content. And so...
Now, this wood shop had a chop saw and a table saw and everything you needed, a drill press, everything you needed to build.
Yeah, and then when the man ordered 100 chairs, I took my brother's charge card and went to Sears and Roebuck and bought a 4-inch joiner and a radial arm saw, and I was in the woodworking business.
And this was, you did this in your parents' garage or your...
In a friend's basement.
In a friend's basement.
Yep. And then when I started making a lot of noise and started into this, he threw my butt out. You make too much noise, too much dust, you're out of here.
And so where did you go then?
I arranged with a friend of mine in Traverse City.
I love it.
Who had a commercial building right downtown Traverse City, and it was, the commercial building was made out of an old dairy, and the upper floors of the building were all offices, but the basement was not being used. And because it had been a dairy, there's some huge pillars in the basement and remnants of where there was some pads where machinery had been set up and different things, and it really wasn't usable as office space whatsoever.
But it was perfect for you.
And it was perfect for me. My agreement with him was that I couldn't make noise during the daytime when people were in the offices above.
So you'd show up about 5 and work till midnight.
I did, I kept my day job. I kept my job at the bicycle shop repairing bicycles.
And now this, you got this bicycle job. When you went in there to get that job, do you remember? Did this guy say, "Well, you're blind, you can't do this," or did you somebody you knew or what?
They had an ad in the paper for a bicycle mechanic. I walked in and said, I can fix bicycles. And the guy says, that one right there needs fixing.
And so you picked,
I was
you,
a bike mechanic.
You picked it up and said, okay, where's a bench I can put it on? And
yep.
Where's your tools?
Yeah, put it in the rack. And here's, you know, that's what he said. Here's the rack. And he didn't even realize, you know, I carried a cane. But he didn't even realize my vision was as bad as it was. I would take a bicycle out of the back door of the shop, and we had a nice little blacktop parking lot around it.
And you'd ride it around?
If the sun was shining really good, I could still tell the difference between the edge of the blacktop and the grass. But
and,
that was it.
And this poor guy didn't know your vision was really as bad as it
was. As bad as it was.
And so he needed a bicycle repairman, and
yep.
Bingo, you had a day job.
Yep.
So you were, and this is all in the summer after high school.
Correct.
And you were bicycle building and working in the afternoon, in the daytime, and then at night you were building chairs for this fellow.
Yep, so I started into doing that.
What a guy. See, that just shows you, if you want to do it, by God, you can.
And then my friend, the boat builder, I was over at his shop one day. This is after I successfully fulfilled my chair contract. And I will tell you, there is a monstrous learning curve between building 10 of something and building 100 of something. I mean,
you think so?
Oh, yeah. Building 10 is, you know, you just kind of piddle along at it. When you need to build 100 of something, you know, it expands just exponentially. I mean,
you figure out how many of these you need, and you just cut 100 of them, or 200 if you need 200 arms. Yep. Well, you cut 200 arms. You know,
these chairs happen to have about 18 pieces in them. So the first time around it was only 180 parts. The next time around it's 1,800 parts.
1,800 parts. Now, how'd you put those together? With drywall screws? No,
they were all put together with rivets.
Okay, pop rivets?
Nope. They're called expanding rivets. You put an anvil on the back side, put a washer on it, and hit it with a hammer.
And it expands and locks down.
Yep. And it also allows movement.
Uh-huh.
Because it just flares the ends of the rivets.
Mm-hmm.
And that way that all your rivets can be hinges where you want.
So you hit it with a hammer, or you put a punch on it and hit the punch?
No, you put it on an anvil and hit it with a ball peen hammer.
Hit it with the round end of a ball peen hammer.
Yep.
And that rounds, that makes the little, that expands both ends of the rivet.
Yep.
And so it allows it. Were these Adirondack type chairs, folding kind of?
It's a folding chair with a canvas seat.
Okay.
It was way too complicated of a first-time project to be doing, but the way it worked out.
I have a chair kind of like that. It folds kind of in the middle. I mean, it doesn't fold front to back. It folds more side to side. Are we talking about the same thing or not?
No, those are called deck chairs or captain's chairs.
They're called director's chairs,
director's,
I think. Director's chairs.
Yeah, this is, the canvas actually is a seat on the one I did, but it goes the opposite direction.
Okay.
And it was kind of a neat design. They've been around for, 100 years.
So you built him 100 and you actually made money doing this?
Well...
Maybe.
It depends on what you thought you may have been paying yourself on an hourly rate.
Okay.
I did make money because, it exceeded the material cost by, a considerable amount. But I probably made, 25 cents an hour.
The church here wanted some picnic tables, and I had built several. So she came to me and said, would you build me 6 picnic tables? And I quoted her a price, and I got a little more than the materials, but I didn't get much per hour.
Okay.
The hourly wage was pretty low. All right, this was the summer of after high school.
Yep.
So
after I was done building those chairs, I was back over at my friend, the boat builders, and I was... helping them out doing some stuff, and a guy came in and wanted some showcases, ironically enough, for a bicycle shop. And so I knew the guy a little bit from having worked at the other bicycle shop, and he's in there wanting to buy showcases, and he points at me and he says, he can build them for you. And the guy says, okay, comes over and starts talking to me about it. And after he left, I said to Chip, I said, Chip, I've never built a showcase. And he goes, well, no time like the present. So...
You had your tools. You had your radial arm saw and your joiner that you bought.
Radial arm saw and a joiner.
You already had those, and so why couldn't you build them?
Well, because lack of confidence of being a young kid, And he says, well, I'll give you a little direction. So he kind of pointed me down the direction, answered questions that I had. I produced this guy some showcases.
Did you have one to look at before?
Nope. He said, I want one 6 foot long, 3 foot tall, 2 feet deep, glass on the top and front, and solid ends, and rolling doors in the back and storage underneath.
Okay.
And
that was
there. And he wanted it out of pine.
And how many did he want?
Just two.
Two.
Yep.
So in the evenings, you built those.
Yep. And before I was even done with that, another friend through the bicycle shop, his brother had just graduated from Ferris State University with a degree in how to make false teeth and bridges and crowns and all of those kinds of things. He was going to set up a lab and needed cabinets for his lab.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, can you build cabinets for my brother? And I said, yep. So, and then it just mushroomed from there. I ran that shop from 1976. Late in 73, 74, before it really got cranking, until 1982.
So you didn't go to college in the fall?
Nope, didn't go back to college.
You did, but you had some college credits that you'd earned in high school.
Yep.
But you were on a good wave, and you figured, what the heck, I'll just ride this.
And wanted to go. The state of Michigan, ironically enough, ran a cabinet building school. The state of Michigan ran one.
Really?
And I wanted to go to school there, and they wouldn't let me go because I was blind back in the 70s. So.
The state of Michigan ran a cabinet-building school for sighted kids.
For disabled persons, people who were missing arms and limbs and hearing problems and people coming out of the correctional institutions and all that, but they wouldn't let blind people go.
Well, of course, nowadays we force them to let you go. They just said, you can't do it?
That's right. They just said, you can't. Nope, we won't let you come here.
I'm amazed with your, now that I've met you in a little bit, I'm amazed that you let them do that.
Well, I was already doing it, so yeah. I just kind of, well, fine, I'll just keep doing it.
Yeah, you didn't really need their help, did you?
Well, I certainly could have used, you know, their expertise, you know, and skills.
Yeah, there are ways to do things, and then there are better ways to do things. And you always want to learn you not only want to work, but you want to work smart.
Yeah. I've always been exceptionally bad at saying, no, I don't know how to do that in my life. People come to me with woodworking projects and projects of all kinds and always say, you know, can you do this? And I stupid me, I've never said no. So I've got into some pretty complex projects in my life.
And so you rode this little wave. Did you continue at the bicycle shop, or did you go full-time with your woodwork?
Well, I continued at the bicycle shop for another, because you got to eat. And that was steady food in the bicycle shop.
Yeah, he was paying you an hourly wage.
That's right. That was steady food. So I would go. My goal was to show up at my shop. I'd go to the work at the bicycle shop in the morning and work until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the bicycle shop, grab something to eat, go to my shop, and get ready and start making noise, you know, about 5:30 or so after everybody cleared out of the building.
And work till midnight.
And my goal was to make last call at the local bar, which was, you know, like 1:45 or so.
Really? And you probably did that every day.
I did that pretty consistently. So I'll tell you, if you're making last call at the bar, you don't have an opportunity to drink very much because they're only going to serve you one beer.
That's right.
You're
out, but you got your beer, and then you went home, went to bed, got up at 7 o'clock the next morning, and went to the bicycle shop by 8.
Yep. Started it again. And I did that for, I guess, 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the man who... And I had an incredible arrangement for my original shop because I did the maintenance on the building, anything that needed fixing, cleaning up, and then I also vacuumed the hallways and cleaned the bathrooms every night, and in the wintertime shoveled the snow.
Man, he had a good deal.
Yeah, well, it was 1,200 square foot for free, basically, just to clean a building, so it was a good deal for both of us. He got something that he needed done, I got something I needed.
Yeah.
And then he passed away, and his daughter inherited the building. And with that, she inherited a little bit of money, and she decided she could hire someone to come in with a jackhammer and, you know, blast out floors in the basement and get that as usable, more rentable space. So she asked me to leave, and at that point in time, I'd built up enough business. I went and bought a building, an old building. It was cheap, I mean, it was an old beat-up building that needed a new roof. And so I put a new roof on the building and moved in it and started working, and it was 3,000 square foot building.
On one of the industrial streets there in Traverse City?
Yep. Kind of tucked away in a corner against the railroad tracks, you know, and it was a spot that didn't have any street visibility, so it made it inexpensive. But for the most part, you know, I did work for contractors and that, so I didn't need a lot of street.
So you were building cabinets for people who were building houses there in town.
Yeah, and then I called my shop an architectural millwork firm, and we did a lot of commercial stuff. In 1978, 79, and 80, the city of Traverse City boomed. I mean, They built new malls. They built new bowling alleys. They remodeled the old courthouse. Everybody was redoing storefronts downtown Traverse City, restoring them back to what they looked like, you know, in the 1800s and things. And I did in the Cherryland Mall there in Traverse City when they first built it. I did 5 storefronts in a row in that mall.
5 storefronts.
Yep, storefronts. And
I don't even know what a storefront is.
It's the part in a mall, when you walk down through a mall, everybody has fancy fronts on their stores with, you know, displays and glass and pretty doors and lots of fancy woodwork. And it kind of sets the stage for what they think the inside of their store. They want you to look at the outside and have an appeal, and then they carry that appeal or that design or concept to the inside. So we did five stores in a row, of which four of them we did the storefronts and all the interior fixtures that went in the store, the checkout counters, the displays for the clothing, cabinetry, and everything.
Now, you keep saying we. You hired some people. You
I had by that, in the mid-1970s, late 70s, I had six guys working full-time for me.
Really?
Yeah, and an office staff of two.
So you had eight people working for you.
Yes.
And this company was owned by you.
By me.
By you.
Called Wurzel Woodworking.
That's pretty amazing in and of itself. Because when you start hiring people, you start having problems.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about that. When you hire somebody, somehow you end up being involved with their aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, cousins.
Oh, yeah, and they think nothing.
Mothers-in-laws.
They think nothing Thursday of calling in sick, and you've got a $5,000 job you need to get out by Saturday.
Yep.
And they think nothing of calling in sick because, they got to take mama to the doctor. We had a restaurant here in town for a while, and it was just, there was always employee problems, constantly. We had a little burger place. So you had eight people working for you, two office staff answering the phone and keeping your books and taking care of business. And I guess it would be easy with a business like that to know if a guy was working, because if you looked at the end of the day and he hadn't done anything, well, he wasn't,
And I have always been on the producing end. I never became the office guy or the manager guy. Matter of fact, I even used to, with my shop, I used to hire a guy who was the shop foreman, and then I used to had a person in the office who was the outside guy who went out and chased work, and in the case of that shop, it was a lady who went out and chased work and did bids and that kind of thing, and I've always been a producer. I've always worked in the shop.
Now she was out looking for jobs for you, but this shop foreman, what did he kept things straight and told you what we need to do this next or we need to?
His job was to keep the workflow going. His job was to assign work to the other employees, and for each job that we did, we always set up a timeline. This part of it needs to be done by this date. This part needs to be done by this date. This needs to be done first before you can do it. You got to put the foundation in before you can put the roof on.
Oh, sure.
And so,
by then you had expanded your collection or your array of tools greatly, because you had lots of stuff then.
I got an SBA loan, and went out and bought a 10 horsepower 20-inch planer.
Now, we're talking about what, you're 76, did you say?
Yeah, right around in there.
So you're 25.
Yep.
And you got an SBA loan.
Yep.
And bought what now? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
10 horsepower, 20-inch planer, big industrial planer, big industrial 12-inch joiner. Had two cutoff saws, table shapers, three table saws, spindle carvers, panel saws. I mean,
and compressor and all that sort of thing.
Complete,
so you were
spray booth.
You were building raised panel doors at that time.
We built raised panel. We would build anybody who walked in the door and wanted something out of wood.
You would build it.
Yep. When they renovated the old courthouse building and restored it back to its original, we built 72 new 7 foot tall, 3 foot wide, six panel oak doors for it. And then we did all of the new baseboard and casing and trim to match the original that had been messed up over the years. And then we redid two courtrooms with all of the rails and the judges' desks. And then we also got to build the 8 foot tall, 4 foot. It was an 8 foot tall opening, 4 feet, no, 8 feet wide that had two large 10-quarter. Raised panel doors with beveled glass and that for the entrance, to replace the entrance doors on the courthouse that someone had taken away years before. And I look at those doors every time I go to Traverse City. I get an opportunity to go up and look at those because they're just massive, huge doors. And I think about how much money I lost on those doors, and not in the building of the doors, in hardwaring them, because they had all of this fancy At the top and bottom of the door, they had self-retracting sill plate and top plate that sealed the doors up from the weather. And all of the panic bar mechanisms and everything were all buried inside the doors. So as you built the doors, you had to build troughs in them for all the mechanisms to run. And it took us longer to hardware the doors than it did to build the doors.
So some of this you did not anticipate, and you say you lost money on those.
On those particular doors, I did.
You know. But you must have had one or two sighted people that you could trust.
Oh, yeah.
You had to have.
I had one key guy in my shop. Scott Clare was his name, and he was my exact same age. We were good buddies. We grew up together, and he was my right-hand guy. And he, you know, between Scott and I, there was never anything that Scott and I didn't say we could do. But I've always been... You know, because I know we're getting short on time here, but I went broke then in 1982.
And the shop went broke?
Shop went broke. City of Traverse City, economics, it just stopped. There was 25% unemployment in the county. Nobody was doing anything.
Hmm.
I had a job in progress for a small independent oil company, and they went broke, and they neglected to make their last $87,000 installment.
And that took care of you. That took you out. Yep.
And, you know, 3 years earlier, probably, if that would have happened, I would have survived because there was enough other work. It would have really hurt, you know, but I would have survived.
Well, you'd have got lots of tax credit for lots of years for that, but
yeah.
You'd had to stay in business to get that tax credit.
Yep.
So this is 83.
83.
Okay, let's take a break, and then you're right, we are not running short of time, but we want to figure out what you've done for the last 23 years. George Wartsfeld is our guest, most interesting life. Be back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me. Hang on.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you looking for broadcast equipment like microphones, telephone interfaces, CD players, anything for your broadcast studio at home, whether you're a professional broadcaster or an amateur just starting out? Well, you should take a look at www.bswonline.com. BSW stands for Broadcast Supply West, or Broadcast Supply Worldwide. One of the two, I'm not sure. They are a great company. They sell tons and tons of professional broadcast equipment, and the great thing about them is every year, a couple times a year, they run what they call an overstock sale, and they sell items that are either overstocked or items that are open box that people have sent back for some reason that they didn't like, or items that are refurbished. And so you can get some really great deals. I've bought some microphones at half price, and they're really an excellent company. Their site's very accessible. They ship very quickly. I buy most of my audio equipment from them. I can't say enough good things about them. I would give the website a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And their website, again, is www.bswonline.com. For Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Guest is George Wartsfeld from, I think you said you live in Lansing now?
Correct, Lansing.
And all this activity happened in Traverse City, where you graduated from the Traverse City High School. Wood shop, big wood shop, 8 employees, went broke in 1983. All right, what did you think then? What did you decide to do then?
Stood up, shook off, turned around 3 times, and says, we've got to do something. I'm not an extravagant person. I mean, I don't live an extravagant lifestyle by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot survive on whatever disability Social Security will pay or SSI or whatever. My life needs are bigger than that. And so I decided what I was going to do. I packed my suitcase and went to Hickory, North Carolina, and went back to college and got a degree in furniture production management.
And they agreed to this. This
is a good story in itself.
They agreed to let a blind guy do it.
Yeah. Well, I looked around where I wanted to go back to college, and knew I wanted to do something in my field that I've been doing. I knew that I had to make myself more marketable. As far as, you know, if I wanted to get out and get the big bucks somewhere. And so I thought going back to college and putting a college degree on top of, you know, my 9 years of experience of running a shop would put me in a good position to get a good job. So I applied to go to their college while I was still in Traverse City, Michigan. I sent them my high school transcripts and a little bit of college that I'd taken. And they sent me a letter back and says, we'd love to have you here.
Did you tell them you couldn't see?
They didn't ask.
And so you didn't tell them?
Yeah.
That's great.
I figured they didn't ask. I didn't tell. Don't ask, don't tell.
But no point in telling them.
That's right.
So you knew you could do it.
I had never visited their school. I had talked to people who graduated from it. It had everything on paper that I thought I was looking for. I got on the Greyhound bus with, you know, two boxes full of stuff and some clothes, and went to Hickory, North Carolina.
Now, did you only have, you weren't married with children, you had no, you
actually,
just...
I was married at that point in time, and my wife stayed in Traverse City.
She did.
And, because she happened to find a nice job.
And so she stayed there, and off George went to North Carolina.
And I was going to be gone for about, you know, 18 months was my plan. And, so... I went down there, I walked in the guy's office, I sat down in the chair, the guidance counselor person or whatever their official names are today, and said, my name is George Wurzel, I'm here, I've signed up to be in your, you know, furniture production management program, and he goes, you're blind. And I said, well, yeah, I'm blind.
They already had your money then.
They already had my money.
Okay.
Said, well, you can't do this. And I says, why? He says, because you're blind. And, He says, you'll get hurt. He says, we run a big industrial shop. So I pull out my portfolio and throw it on his desk and said, this is what I've been doing for the last 8 years, you know, and 9 years. And he takes a look at it, and he's somewhat impressed. And he says, you actually run equipment and that? And I said, yeah. He says, well, I just don't know if it's going to work. And I said to him, I says, well, sir, are you blind? And he goes, no, I'm not blind. I says, why are you missing fingers on your right hand? And he says, well, I cut them off. And I says, well, I want the same opportunity you had.
How did you know he was missing fingers?
Took hands with him.
And he was missing fingers on his hand.
Fingers.
And that's a great line. That is a great line. I love it. I want the same opportunity you have. What did he say? Did he start laughing?
He just couldn't argue that point.
Now, there was no place to go there.
Yeah.
So he said, okay, come on.
He said, well, let me take you over and introduce you to the guy who teaches all the shop classes. He says, well, I'm going to have to work into this slow. We go over there. I shake hands with this guy. He's only got a thumb and one finger on his hand, on his right hand.
Oh, yeah. So,
and I just, I'm going to learn safety from this guy, right? And
yeah,
I
said
to the guy that took me in, and he just, that was it. I was in right then and there.
That was it. All right, you didn't have any, would you just look around, cast about, and say, do you all know a rooming house I could stay in?
I called up the local realtor, and this is in Hickory, North Carolina, in 1983. I call up a local realtor. I told her I'm looking for a very inexpensive place to live real close to the college, hopefully within walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
And she says to me, quote, would you like indoor plumbing? And I says, I guess my definition of real inexpensive needs to go up a few notches.
Would you like, yeah, I like that. And so she found you someplace to?
She did. And within walking distance, nice little place, little two-room apartment, and it was just perfect. It was, you know, 15-minute walk from the school.
And, of course, then you had to go out that night and find yourself a bar.
Yeah, well, I've been known to do that on rare occasions.
Once or twice in your life.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I'd have done after supper.
Yeah,
would have been gone.
And so I was started in at the school. If you know the furniture industry a little bit, there are two big furniture shows every year, one in the fall and one in the spring.
I did not know that.
And where everybody shows off their wares and their new line for the new year and everything. And that takes place in High Point, North Carolina, which was, you know, 90 miles from where I was living.
Yep.
And so one of the guys in one of my classes works for a guy who's a furniture sample builder. And he says, comes into the class one day, he says, my boss is desperate. He needs, you know, 6-8 guys to help him, you know, get this stuff finished up and get out so it's ready for the furniture market. And he looks at me, he says, you want to go? And I said, well, sure. So we go down to this guy's place, and the guy takes one look at me and says, you're blind. He says, can you assemble chair frames? And I said, well, yeah, I can assemble chair frames. And he sits me up at a bench. He says, here they are. Start going at it. So I look at the one that's already done, and I look at the pile of parts. And they come to you kind of, they have some sub-assemblies that they do. And where I was, where I started in there, the back frames and everything was all assembled.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to put the front frame assembly was assembled, so putting the stretchers in between the front and the back and getting the arm stumps on, and then it went to the next people down the, you know.
So not really much. I mean, that's
pretty darn simple.
That's pretty simple.
Glue in, you know, 15 yeah. or 20 holes or whatever it was, put the parts in between. You know, throw one strap clamp on it and two bar clamps and shove it over to the person to the right of you.
And the guy to the right of you does something else.
Yep, and he did something else.
Does he clean up your glue mess?
No.
If you made any. You clean your own.
Yeah, you're responsible for your own glue.
Okay, so you did that for this guy, and you were going to school, and you got to...
Yep, and that job was supposed to last, you know, 3 to 4 days. We started on a Thursday night after school. Friday was always a short day at the school. So went back on Friday, worked Friday afternoon until like 11 o'clock at night, worked all day Saturday and all day Sunday for the stuff. The show opens on Tuesday.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm out of work on, you know, basically out of work on Sunday night when we're done.
Yeah.
The show takes place. The guy who runs this little operation calls me back on Wednesday and asks me if I'd like a job.
And so now not only were you going to school, but you had a job.
I was going to school and had a job.
And had a job at night or whenever you could get over there.
Yep.
All right. Like you say, we're running kind of short of time. So you finished the furniture school in, what, a year, 2 years?
I'm actually, to this point in time in my life, I'm still one class short of having a degree from them.
You did not finish.
Which I'm planning on doing here in the next fall. I'm going to go back to school here and finish it up and get that degree plus another one.
Okay, we're up to 1985 now, and we're down to about 6 minutes. What did you do?
I stayed in North Carolina for 15 years, working in the furniture industry. The reason that I never finished my degree was a man came to me and said, I want to build a European-style kitchen cabinet manufacturing plant. Are you interested? And so I built from scratch. He had the building. I bought all the machinery, all the equipment, set it all up, and hired the first batch of employees and put out the first $300,000 worth of production out the door.
Now, what did he mean by European style?
There's no face frames on European style cabinets. It's just a square box or rectangular box, 3/4 inch thick, and the doors are put on the front with European style hinges, which is a little cup hinges. And a lot of the do-it-yourself, assemble-yourself furniture, Sauter and O'Sullivan and that they sell at Kmart and Walmart and that, are all made in those conditions.
Now, you say it is just a square box with doors...
On the front.
On the front, but there's no facing, there's no trim around. Like
there's no frame exposed between the doors like you'd have in a standard kitchen cabinet.
And these doors fit inside the box? Or
they mount on the very front.
They mount on the very front, so they cover up the edges.
Yep.
And they're all
built out of melamine, you know, infused particle board, you know, or plastic laminate on the outside of particle board. So
uh-huh.
The interiors are all clean and smooth, and all your commercial cabinetry is pretty much built, you know, that way. And then a huge amount of kitchen cabinets are built that way. Now, if you read at any magazines or anything, or you go into a kitchen store, they have what they call full-access cabinetry or frameless cabinetry or European cabinetry. That's all the style that it is.
And that's what it is?
Yep.
Where you don't... I don't quite understand the hinge. Does it... I don't know that I've ever seen one.
Mounts to the back side of the door and then mounts to the side of the cabinet, so you see no hinges at all from the front of the cabinet window.
Okay, but then if the edge of the door is sticking out, you couldn't open the door.
Well, you can, though, because of how the hinge is designed. The hinge actually lets the door come out forward from the cabinet.
A little bit.
Yep.
And then opens.
Yep.
You know, I've seen those hinges. I just didn't know what they were called.
Yep.
So you actually were got to making money, and school became secondary.
Yeah. Yep. At the same point in time, I'd been in North Carolina for about 9 months or so, and my wife's mother and her had a little conference and decided that maybe I was never going to come back and that I was a worthless scumbag anyways, and I did go broke, and they told me goodbye. So I stayed in North Carolina for 15 years.
So that ended your marriage?
Yep.
And you say they went broke. They were running a business in Traverse City or something?
No. They told me just goodbye, and so they weren't.
That was it for you, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
But, so I worked for I got this plant up and running. The plant was all automated. It had roller conveyors from machine to machine. The parts would go through a machine. You put them back on the roller conveyors. You moved it to the mix machine. It went through that. And then until it got to the assembly process, and then they were assembled in the cabinets out the door. And I got all done, got it up and running, got the first production out the door, and I wanted more money. He didn't want to pay me more money. And being the stubborn, pig-headed person that I've been most of my life, I said, well, I want more money. And he says, I'm not giving you more. I said, fine, I'm leaving. So I quit.
And went and did what?
I started a company of my own called Sell America. I had a wild and crazy idea. I made triangular-shaped wooden box for veterans internment flags and sold them to funeral homes. I did the original production myself out of my garage of 100 boxes, did the marketing, set up the whole company, and then put my skills that I had learned to work at the college and subcontracted out every aspect of the production of those products and became a desk jockey. And sold, at that point in time, there was about 25,000 funeral homes in the United States, and within 18 months, I had 2,500 of them as customers.
Uh-huh.
And was doing well, and got a contract with the military, with the Army, to produce products, and was working on a contract to produce products for the Navy, and didn't have enough capital. I was way short of capital. And I went to a couple banks, and at that point in time, in the mid-1980s, interest rates were around 16 or 18%. And so it was hard to find money that was affordable. And I went to a private investor, and he says, well, I'm not really interested in investing in your company. I'd like to buy it. So I said, how much money you got? And he wrote me a nice big check. And the best part about selling it was the fact that he paid me royalties for 3 years afterwards. I used
really?
To consistently go to my mailbox every
and
month.
And there'd be a check.
And there'd be a check.
All right, now this took you through the 90s.
Yep. And
we've got about a minute left. What are you doing now?
I run a camp for blind kids.
A camp for blind kids.
Yep.
I'll tell you what let's do. I've got an interview that I did the other day that I got about 47 minutes out of, so I need about 7 more minutes.
Okay.
Why don't we run this 1 week and then continue next week with the end of the George Wortschel story?